Hi, podcasters. This is Brooke with Let's Talk Art. Today I'm talking art with Dr. Susan Edwards, who is the curator of the Power of Pictures exhibit. This exhibit originated at the Jewish Museum in New York and is now happening at the Frist Center in Nashville, Tennessee. It goes until July 4th. We are still in the process of lining up sponsors for Let's Talk Art with Brooke, but in the meantime, if you'd like to support the podcast, please look for my book, Reptiles on Caffeine, on Amazon. Enjoy the podcast. Okay. I'm talking to Dr. Susan Edwards, who's the curator of the Power of Pictures exhibit, which originated at the Jewish Museum in New York and is now traveling at the Frist Center for the Visual Arts in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Dr. Edwards. How you doing?
Fine, thank you. How are you, Brooke?
I'm doing great. I'm very excited to be talking to you. I've been real excited about this exhibit. I don't know a whole lot about it, honestly, about the Soviet history, but I do know, I know about propaganda, and I know I'm just interested in what this exhibit is.
Well, first let me say, I actually wasn't the curator on staff. Katie Delmay is a curator for that. I'm the director here. Mm-hmm. But we took this show and were delighted to know about it when the Jewish Museum initially approached us, because the period between the world wars, a lot happens with photography that has a great deal to do with our visual culture today.
Mm-hmm.
This is a period when there's the beginning of having roll film, handheld cameras, and mass-produced journals for the publication of images.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the first time that effectively, mm-hmm. on a broad scale, that a government such as the new rethought Soviet Union would have the opportunity to enlist new media such as film and photography for political cause.
Mm-hmm.
This was a universal, happened all over the globe almost simultaneously, because all of these inventions came about at once. Although photography had been invented in the 19th century, mm-hmm. mass distribution of images didn't occur until the 1920s.
Much later, right.
Like a camera.
Mm-hmm.
So initially, there were many experimental ways that photographers specifically were using cameras and cameraless methods, such as photograms.
Mm-hmm.
But it was soon realized that the power of pictures was so intense that
right.
government, specifically the Soviet government, could enlist these same artists and technicians for a larger political agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that happened in Germany,
mm-hmm.
With the Nazis, in Italy with the fascists,
right.
in Japan, and also, obviously, among communist ideology in the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
But we did something very similar in the United States when the Roosevelt administration enlisted photography, and specifically the Resettlement Administration, to create a photo archive of conditions in America.
Mm-hmm.
So it has great universal appeal, and we need to be very well educated
right.
about the power of pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And now, as we all have that power in our own hands, and are inundated by so many images,
right.
it's hard to even imagine where we were 100 years ago, but also how we can use our own visual images for good or not such good
right.
images.
Right. So, yeah, it's amazing. You can just, like, these days you can just share pictures, like, just at the drop of a hat, and you didn't have that back then.
But it's sort of a continuum, and the distribution and use of photography has sort of catapulted. It's sort of like Star Wars, it just goes to another level with digital imaging and handheld cameras now, or your cell phone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You don't need dark rooms, and you don't need roll film. It really changes everything.
Right, right.
It's always good to be a wise consumer and understand the power of the pictures that you have in your own cell phone.
Indeed, indeed. So like what kinds of things were, what kind of things were people trying to convey with these pictures?
Well, the Soviet government quickly realized that, you know, following the revolution, that they had new messages that they wanted to get out. And they enlisted these same artists to send these messages, and they were looking at things like the construction of socialism, mm-hmm. and what it meant to live in a metropolitan area, mm-hmm. The military might, physical culture. And these were not messages that were specifically Soviet, because they were also embraced by the buildup of the Nazi Party as well. Mm-hmm. And they would also create, you know, ways to stage the happy, the happiness of their citizenry.
Right.
How the 5-year agriculture plan was working. Mm-hmm. And they were showing things like how electricity came to the country at that time.
Uh-huh.
So it was in support of communist ideology.
Right. Showing how happy everyone was because of communist ideology, communist laws. So that makes sense. Yeah, you certainly wouldn't want to portray the scariness of it.
Well, and there were other things that, you know, aesthetically that changed dramatically at this moment that reinforced that, because the use of new camera angles, a worm's eye view or a bird's eye view, or something that sort of made something familiar look a bit more abstract, really had a little bit of shock value at that time.
Right.
And so people were looking at things with very fresh eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And so then there was a sort of incorporation of a new avant-garde photographic strategy that played into how images can transmit and speak to something that might be political, so that you could aggrandize an army by sort of making it look less individual but more unified, mm-hmm. so that it became kind of a nationalism conveyed through the power of pictures.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, when I look at these pictures, I just think they look kind of sinister and scary. And I don't know if that's just because I know the background of them, or if it's just the photo techniques, or just the primitive nature of it, maybe. They just seem kind of scary to me.
Well, clearly all of the above, but, you know, literacy in our lifetime has come to mean not just the knowledge of being able to read words, but also our ability to read images.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that point, you know, people looked upon these somewhat innocently, and I think this is the reason many of us are in study art history or work in this field, is to be sure that we are always aware of how we are manipulated by images that we see, whether those are in advertising or used in propaganda or pornography or any other view.
Mm-hmm.
That photographs are enlisted for, as I said earlier, they may be enlisted for something that has, you know, a warm and fuzzy message, but they may also be used for something more sinister.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're literate in visual imaging, then we cannot fall prey or victim to manipulation by images. So it's the way we educate ourselves.
Right.
Both through the things that we read and know about something, and then we see how someone might use an image to be the shortcut to 1,000 words. These images, these particular photographs, also came about at a time when many people in the Soviet Union were illiterate.
Mm-hmm.
So they were meant to tell stories.
Right.
And to convey very powerful messages.
Right.
And they were very, very effective to mm-hmm. that end.
Right. Right. Why do you think that, I understand that clearly if people can't read, then they're going to get a reaction from the, they're going to get a sense from the pictures of what's going on. But like, why do you think that the pictures evoke more of an emotional response to us than say words would?
Well, I think that we have to remember that actually about art, sometimes we think we need to know a lot about the history around it, mm-hmm. but we are visual before we are literary, so that, as human beings, we're going to have a more visceral response to images just because we recognize ourselves in them.
Right.
And so we somatize our emotional responses to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's prelingual.
Mm-hmm.
Our response to those, speaking of the primitive brain, I mean, naturally, we would have a much more visceral response to something that we recognize, such as the tender embrace of a mother and a child, a kind of maternal love. It doesn't take many words to see that. I think any one of us who's ever experienced that would recognize that when we see it.
Right, right. Let's talk about some of the pictures that are in the exhibit. What kinds of images are in the exhibit?
Well, there's a wide range from the most avant-garde techniques and strategies to those that become clearly propagandistic.
Mm-hmm.
And the exhibition is laid out in a way that shows us the experiments that were happening and why they were happening at this time, because it was a new medium that had new technologies. Looking at things that hadn't been seen before, taking photographs, aerial views of something, looking at something from what we call the worm's eye view or the bird's eye view, gave us new perspectives. We see abstract forms, which are actually, in reality, just have to do with how the camera angle is positioned.
Mm-hmm.
There are other strategies, such as photograms, where light-sensitive paper, objects are put directly on light-sensitive paper. And then of these experimental techniques that were practiced by these early Soviet photographers were also practiced at the Bauhaus and in France at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Then these techniques become something that are very ways that we very effectively can convey messages about looking at the world around us with fresh eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And then quite literally, some of the patterning and things that we see in the images by Rodchenko or others, Ignatovich or Petrosov or other experimental photographers, began to infiltrate the sort of messaging of those artists who were listed, like Selma and Henson and others, to convey messages about the power and strategies of the Soviet government.
Mm-hmm.
They have very deliberate political plans for increasing food supply for a vast nation. I mean, we often forget how enormous Russia, the former Russia, the new Soviet Union was.
Mm-hmm.
But also how they had to get everyone on the same page. So there are many of these avant-garde strategies that become enlisted for what essentially become political images that convey the good of the cause, a more collaborative and communal agenda of sacrificing self for the good of many.
Mm-hmm.
So in images you may see soldiers or union workers, and you lose the individuality.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at the numbers of people working together.
Right.
In the images that deal with physical culture, it's part of the agenda there where they're using both avant-garde current populace that the government was enlisted to help feed and create a physical health of the whole culture.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that good government would be responsible for.
Mm-hmm.
So they're saying, here we are, we're effective in doing that.
Right.
I mentioned earlier, just seeing things like hygiene, public hygiene. I mean, the fact that the public didn't always enjoy good hygiene, to show that there was running water, to show that there were electricity coming to heat water, to provide refrigeration,
mm-hmm.
the absence of spoilage. And so all of these messages about how the common good was sort of constantly in the government.
Mm-hmm.
They were widely disseminated because of the publication of tabloids and other mass-produced magazines.
Right.
I don't want to discount the popularity of film.
Uh-huh.
Because it just became, it's hard for us to even imagine how almost magical film was and how popular it was among the masses to see living images. Look at film.
Right.
And films were dealing with many of the political issues of the day.
Yeah, I'm sure that film was especially, people were especially interested in film because it was so new then.
Right.
Like the movies, rather, I mean, is what I mean.
Well, not only was film new, but the whole idea of the masses having access to any of the popular forms of popular culture.
Right, right. The people who were producing these photos and movies, were they how were they picked? How were they hired? Were they trained in any kind of way, or did they just? I mean, how did they go about producing these things?
Well, they were the leading artists of the day. One of the reasons that this exhibition was organized by the Jewish Museum is because this is not long after pogroms, and many people who became interested in film and photography were artists who may have not had access to the traditional academic art institutions, and so they began to explore alternative media,
mm-hmm.
And looked at film and photography.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a propensity of Jewish creative geniuses,
mm-hmm.
quite frankly,
mm-hmm.
who found a vehicle for their creativity. So they are being trained more by one another and supported in art schools, less so by the state. It was much more that these methods were co-opted by the state than
mm-hmm.
that they were trained specifically by the state.
Right.
Eventually, of course, the state takes over everything. So, you know, they're taking over all of the publications and the art schools as well. But it's a very good question about the chicken and the egg there.
Yeah, yeah. I was, I mean, I can't imagine that, you know, everyone would have been in line with the government. So the government was just kind of told them what to say or told them what to produce, like what the content was, what message to say?
Yes and no, because this is a trajectory through this, you know, 20-year period between the world wars, with a large focus in the 20s and 30s. So, no, everyone didn't embrace everything. The technique for montage also produced a number of sort of splinter critiques,
mm-hmm.
that were less valued, but all of this is occurring simultaneously, which I think is another extremely interesting thought about how montage and collage and different techniques were used in this period, some for the good of the cause, you know, were part of the critique at the same time.
Right.
And some people left the Soviet Union for exactly the same reason, because and later people left Nazi Germany or fascist Italy,
mm-hmm.
For exactly the same reasons that they bought into the idea of Agit Prop, the idea that it was something that was going to be great for the masses. Remember, we're coming off of, you know, sort of imperial Russia. Mm-hmm. And after the revolution, everyone is looking, hopefully, at a new government, and that many of the governments who have a sort of rhetoric that we recognize much more easily today, mm-hmm. At the time, those nations that were building their power based on support of the masses were not so transparent in how they were going to become totalitarian. Mm-hmm. And so things sort of evolve over time. And I think that we as consumers of visual culture today are much more sophisticated when we hear the red flags of dangerous rhetoric, or right. We see in propaganda images something that, as you said earlier, appear very frightening to us.
Right.
They didn't initially to people at the time, but they did eventually.
Right, right. Yeah, so what you said that they weren't always as trans, they weren't as, or they were, they weren't, they were transparent with the messages, and so what can you give some examples of that?
Well, I think that what I was saying earlier is that when people were artists, particularly, were asked would they be willing to make their messages more direct, mm-hmm. to support the Soviet agenda. Mm-hmm. It was a firm belief that the Soviet agenda was for the good of everyone.
Right.
That it wasn't something. So I think that images where artists were supporting the health or the notion of electricity coming to the masses, that there would be plenty of food for everyone, that this was something that the government believed in, mm-hmm. That nature was something that would be protected, that there would be other aspects of the culture that would be for the betterment of people who had suffered terribly under previous regimes.
Uh-huh.
And then only, you know, later than did it become aware that the government would soon crack down and be much more totalitarian, and that everyone would be enlisted for a cause that was going to be not necessarily for the good of everyone and create a culture of suspicion, mm-hmm. and much more punitive and rejecting of immigrants, for example, or you know, the other.
Right.
So it wasn't clear from the beginning what direction communism would take.
Right. Right. So yeah, actually, it sounds good on paper, but yeah, once it gets into practice, it's not implemented very well.
Right.
So how did you get into this? How did you get into learning about all this?
My dissertation topic is on photography between the world wars, so it is something that I've been interested in for many years, and this exhibition just was especially appealing to me, mm-hmm. because I think this period between 1919 and 1939 is extremely interesting on a global basis.
Right.
So I think probably can't even remember when I wasn't interested in it now.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a fascinating time period. There's lots of changes, lots of influences.
Almost everything that happened with film and photography in this period, from the experimental to the surrealist to this sort of almost international shift towards a much more literal and a kind of realism, which when it's applied to good is a social realism. But when applied to marshaling large populations for something that's less than good, it's how we can see that it's so important for us to understand the power of pictures and how they can convey messages.
Right.
And I think we as consumers, we're consumers of a political agenda, we're consumers of material goods, and I think we want to be knowledgeable about the messages that are conveyed to us.
Right.
Using, and today, you know, obviously still photographs continue, but also moving images of film and through advertising.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's a... Yeah, I was an advertising major in college. So yeah, and use all kinds of
subliminal messages.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, that's one thing, but also just that something that would sell objects that feeds into capitalism and consumerism is the sort of latent rather than subliminal, but latent messages of popularity and sexuality and other things that we seek on an unconscious level.
Right, right. Yeah, and I was going to say, I don't know that it's like, you're not like intentionally trying to like put messages in there, but just kind of, you want to portray it as, you know, this will make your life better. And not necessarily,
Well, there's and it appeals to our sense of what we're missing.
Mm-hmm. So, exactly.
And, you know, we have a sense that we're incomplete if we don't have romantic love and all the material comforts in the world.
Right.
Or potential material comfort. And then, you know, that escalates into something that can be very unhealthy at the same time. While it's wonderful to have running water and electricity for health and well-being, I'm not sure that we all need luxury goods in the way that we feel
that
they complete us today.
Yeah.
And I think also, you know, not to get too far afield, but we also have constructions of our own, or validation of our own gender identity, that we are beautiful and appealing because we have a singular form of beauty.
Right.
And that if we don't have that, that somehow or other we are invalid.
Yes.
To understand how we allow ourselves to buy into that is something that's always been tremendously interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
That's back to my idea about being educated consumers of visual culture is extremely important to us to be fulfilled human beings.
Yeah, I've always found that really, really fascinating. I think that's why I was so interested in advertising and wanted to do it. But I think this has been so great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate this, Susan.
Oh, thank you for your time. We hope you'll have the opportunity to get here. We know we're less than a day's drive from a lot of the country, and hope that you can find your way over. We'd love to welcome you to Nashville and to the center to see this exhibition.
So, well, actually, I think we're going to be making a road trip to St. Louis in June. And so we might try to stop by then.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah.
We'd love for you to see this exhibition in person.
Cool. That sounds awesome. Well, thank you so much, Susan.
Thank you again, Brooke.
So hang on one second. Turn this off and I will.
Thank you so much to Dr. Susan Edwards for telling us about the Power of Pictures exhibit that's happening at the Frist Center for the Visual Arts in Nashville, Tennessee. And thank you to you for listening. I know I learned a lot, and if you're in the Nashville area, check out the Frist Center. You'll definitely not want to miss this exhibit. If you're interested in having us promote your product or service, if you have a comment, if you have any ideas for future podcasts, or would like to be on the show yourself, please contact me at arttalkwithbrooke@gmail.com. That's Brooke with an E and all one word.